Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction, and I'm joined by my colleagues Maggie Pagano and Alistair Benn. I think we're going to talk a bit today about our Defence of Europe conference, which was on Monday at King's College in London, partnership between Reaction and King's College London. And then I think we're also going to talk about Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland Protocol, and a bit of Brexit-related politics. And of course, we're going to touch on the war and the deal between the UK, Sweden and Finland, or Sweden and Finland's move towards joining NATO. And then maybe a little bit of working from home, Maggie, you wanted to talk about. But you had some questions first, Maggie, on the Northern Ireland Protocol and what's going on there, because you thought that I could maybe bring some clarity. I'm not sure I can, actually. It's such a complex, confusing situation, but I'll do my best.
Ian, I think other than the sort of real political nerds, to most of it, it is an absolute mystery. And as always, one tries to search for some sort of objective truth in what's going on, which I find incredibly hard. So my question is, I have many questions. We signed up to this. Johnson and Lord Frost, you know, they negotiated this in faith and thought it would work. Now they're the ones saying we've got to redo it. So the first question is, did they know it wouldn't work but needed to just get something done? Or have things changed and that there is a valid position for us to go back to the EU and say we want to renegotiate this?
Wow, a lot in there to unpack. So why did they sign it? Let's be honest. It was pretty. They would not frame it in these terms, but it was pretty cynical, but born of a desire to, that terrible Boris phrase, just get Brexit done. So there was a feeling that, look, Parliament had almost managed to halt or reverse Brexit, or at least had almost got to a second referendum. It didn't happen. There was Brexiteer terror that the entire project would be lost. And so it was just a view in late 2019, get the thing done, get something signed, get out, and then with an expectation that it could be fixed or improved later on once Britain had left. And of course, the Northern Ireland Protocol is there designed to deal with this tension, which I'll admit lots of Brexiteers like me didn't fully understand the implications or didn't think through the implications adequately, that leaving Northern Ireland, that leaving the European Union put Northern Ireland in a tricky position, because it also has a border, a direct land border with a member of the European Union, which is in the single market. The European Union wanted to protect that single market border. So how do you manage the trade flow between Britain and Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland and the Republic, Northern Ireland and Ireland? And the Northern Ireland Protocol was the patch together thing. And I think Boris, according to Dominic Cummings, his erstwhile aide, didn't really understand it, claims Cummings. But actually, I think Boris probably did understand it, but just thought, use it, get out. What's happened now is the Northern Ireland elections have taken place, and the UK government says, look, the protocol isn't working. The largest party, Sinn Féin, obviously wants to keep the protocol, but the second largest party, the DUP, doesn't and wants it scrapped, renegotiated, reformed almost to the point of extinction. And why is that a problem? Well, the EU is now shouting at the British government saying, look, you signed the protocol, you have to stick with it and implement it. But in a way, it's no longer that simple. Like nothing is in Northern Ireland politics, because the DUP, according to the way in which the Good Friday Agreement works, or the institutions which flowed from the Good Friday Agreement, the DUP has a de facto veto. And that might be annoying to the European Union, or annoying to anti-Brexiteers, or annoying to some Brexiteers, but it's simply the way that the system works. So this afternoon, we're recording on Friday afternoon, it seems that, unless something dramatic happens, that the DUP will effectively block the election of a speaker, first meeting since the election, and the institutions then can't function, and the Northern Ireland office effectively takes over, and you don't have devolution functioning as it's envisaged in the Good Friday Agreement. Does that answer some of it?
Some of it. So it was probably in good faith, well, cynical good faith. But if the circumstances have changed, surely it's in both sides' interest to come back to the negotiating table to get a better agreement. So why are we sort of, you know, threatening? And is it fair that we're saying the EU is being intransigent? Or is it fair to say, actually, the Brits, tough luck, that's what you negotiated, you just got to, you know, stick it?
Well, I mean,
is there some room for manoeuvre?
Well, they can say, the EU can say, tough luck, the Brits signed it and the Northern Ireland Protocol cannot be scrapped or substantially renegotiated. But as the EU is discovering, I think, and I've got in some trouble on Twitter for making this point, I thought as calmly as possible, I don't think that the EU fully understands what it's got itself into in Northern Ireland politics. I think that's partly because it's been driven by an understanding, brief to it, or strategy defined by Dublin and the Irish government since the whole kind of Brexit negotiation mess started. But I don't think it understands now, it's not just, there aren't just two sides. It's not the Brits and the EU. Because of the Good Friday Agreement, which the EU had nothing to do with in terms of the negotiating process back in 98 and the starting of the and the establishment of the institutions. The EU, of course, is a factor because there was then a single market which the UK was part of, so it made the functioning of the Good Friday Agreement easier, but it wasn't a negotiating party. And I think it's still thinking of it in terms of two sides, the UK and the EU. But the Good Friday Agreement, the way that it functions, as I explained, is that it gives nationalists and unionists, the two largest parties of whichever block, an effective veto if they are unhappy with any changes to arrangements, which the Northern Ireland Protocol is. The DUP, so people can be as rude as they like about the DUP or say that the British government should force them to comply. Well, how is it supposed to do that? Because anyone who understands anything about Northern Ireland politics knows that the Ulster Unionists are DUP, the UUP are really suspicious of and distrustful of the UK government. That's not a new development. The fact that the DUP propped up the May government when it didn't have a working majority is a blip, really. Historically, the unionist community always fears, with some justification, unionists would say, being sold out by London and by the Brits. And what Boris did on the protocol is seen in some parts of the unionist tradition as proof of that. Once again, you know, the unionist community was opposed to the Anglo-Irish agreement that Thatcher signed. I was just reading Charles Moore's a very good account of how that process happened earlier this morning for something I'm going to write on all of this. So there was that sense of betrayal. It's not new. The Ulster Unionist, the DUP, distrust London. So the EU has to persuade, or the UK government and the EU have to somehow find something that the DUP can accept, and that Sinn Féin, the nationalist side, can accept. That's what the Good Friday Agreement is. It's a complex fudge, as the border itself has always been, even since partition. Shortly after partition, effectively the common travel area or common travel agreement came into force, and the Brits and the Irish have a long and troubled, difficult history of trying to negotiate these and navigate these complex things. But the EU seeing it in binary terms. It was signed by the Brits, therefore the Brits must comply. But the Good Friday Agreement, which the EU, I think, is slowly starting to understand what it means and how it works, gives the DUP a veto.
Surely there's scope for a kind of grand bargain type thing. You know, everyone wants, more or less, right, the Northern Ireland Protocol to work, sort of. And, you know, because it is true, isn't it, that the DUP have, they're not totally against the protocol. What would it make, you know, what has to change for them to kind of be on board? Surely everyone has to get together in a country house over 2 weeks and just do some very hard, you know, conversations about, you know, where the checks happen, EU concerns about, you know, I think, isn't it the concern that if there isn't kind of border arrangements on the island, then Northern Ireland would be a kind of backdoor into the European market and might be,
yeah,
you know, products might be flooded in, you know, exploiting the kind of, you know, the way goods are flowing. And surely there's a way of making this work, because everyone has a shared interest in there be, you know, everyone has that shared interest in making it work. And so surely there should be a kind of diplomatic solution. Sorry, that is incredibly, you know, boring and banal thing to say, but it just strikes me as everyone, the rhetoric is so heated, and we're saying, you know, junk this, junk that. Everyone has a shared interest in making this work in Northern Ireland, especially the people who live there.
Yes, but if up to a point, and you're being very, very rational about it, but this is my point about Northern Ireland politics, which I'm not claiming to be an expert on, but just observing from a distance and talking to, you know, various people involved in it down the years, down the decades, it just tends not to. I mean, it's not that long ago that large numbers of people were being murdered over these related questions. You know, nearly 3,000 lives lost in the Troubles, and it doesn't fit the, and that's the extraordinary thing about the Good Friday Agreement, that people did come together and forge something against expectations, but it just doesn't work logically. And the EU is not, it seems, prepared to move, though the EU claims that it has moved a bit on what's called easement, making the Northern Ireland Protocol in its terms, or agreeing easements which would make the thing function properly or to its satisfaction. But that's not enough for the DUP and not enough for the UK government. I think what the UK government is right in doing, and I accept, to anyone listening saying, look, this is the fault of Brexiteers, I accept, as someone who voted for Brexit, that Brexiteers were throughout too casual about this problem. And when you say, Alistair, shouldn't everyone get together and everyone has an interest in it? That was my approach in 2016 and beyond. I just thought, come on, it's always been a fudged border. Surely there are ways, if people sit down and talk for long enough, you can find compromises to ensure there isn't a return to violence and that the thing functions properly. But that's not how the EU chose to view it and sees it in very simple binary terms of protection of the single market. And Brexiteers just kept saying over and over again, well, what about alternative arrangements or computer using computer checks? And it sounds plausible to me, but that's not enough for the EU and not enough for the Irish government. So I'm actually pretty gloomy about this, which it seems incredible. There is a real live war happening in Europe, and it seems to me something that requires exactly what you describe, Alistair: country house talks, compromise on all sides, patching together a new version of the protocol that works. But I don't see who's going to move on this. I can't see the European Union doing enough to satisfy the DUP, who are distrustful of the UK government. So the thing is stuck and it looks unfixable.
But nothing is unfixable, but doesn't it need, I mean, you know, not knowing enough about it, but seeing it, watching it, all one sees is sort of belligerence and rhetoric. I mean, Liz Truss is the foreign secretary. Surely, in a sense, the onus is on her to bring the EU, as Alistair says, to a table, get, I don't know, Tony Blair, John Major, a great diplomat, let's find, think of someone, to host something like that, because there has to be a, there must be, it, there has to be.
But
a,
the DUP, but
PFA
the DUP,
or something.
Yeah, I know, but that's, but that is, that that's, Maggie, with respect, that's London thinking. There's no way that the DUP are going to trust Tony Blair, the architect of the Good Friday Agreement, right? Mm. So, which the DUP, remember, the DUP were skeptical of the Good Friday Agreement. Actually, walked out, I think, at one point. And so, the Good Friday Agreement comes close to destroying, destroys the Ulster Unionist Party. They're then replaced with the more, so the hardliners, the DUP, gain the ascendancy after, you know, hence Ian Paisley becoming First Minister. So Blair and Major aren't people that they want to hear from. I've heard it suggested by various people, including a Reaction subscriber who I think is probably listening to this podcast, that you then end up with an American envoy. Maybe you do, but is the European Union ready for an American envoy from Biden? Which also, remember, the DUP are unlikely to trust an emissary who comes from the Biden administration, considering Biden's politics and his take on Irish and Northern Irish politics. They'd be very distrustful of that. And the EU is unlikely to want to see America being the interlocutor or the broker on finding a way through. Sorry, I know I keep, just keep suggesting, I just keep putting up roadblocks or reasons why things can't work. But that, and you said, Maggie, nothing's unfixable. Sometimes in historical problems like this, they are unfixable, and there is no logical answer that all parties will accept, which history suggests when it comes to Northern Ireland means after the tragic history of that place is you have to patch something together, but patching something together that is a fudge, that is a compromise, or that is contains within it some kind of internal contradiction, is not how the EU sees this problem. It sees it, as I said, in absolutely binary terms. So everyone is stuck.
So we're ruling out a kind of cheesy, I mean, it sounds cheesy, I was saying, you know, like the Camp, if you watch like documentaries about, you know, for example, the Camp David negotiations between Arafat and the Israelis. And you know, this is, you know, in the kind of high point of American unipolar kind of optimism. And what is remarkable about actually looking at the kind of old footage of those events and the kind of diplomatic to and fro is how much can be achieved by an American president who's really, really committed to getting something done and who is actually kind of willing to go between sides and compromise a bit and do all the sort of dirty diplomatic stuff and just really up for it, you know. And that's what I'm trying to get at, is like surely there's an international kind of guarantee source where that can come from. Mm. And obviously it clearly can't be from America because of it's so prejudged, you know, but the Biden administration have made loads of comments about the situation over the last couple of years, which make it harder for them to be involved. But I don't know, surely there's another format, you know, like a Normandy format, as they say, or whatever.
A top judge or somebody from the, I don't know, there must be somebody in the international community that all sides would respect.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
There just aren't. I mean, if you pick someone who's respected by the DUP, they're not going to be respected by Sinn Féin, who emerged as the largest party. I mean, that's the other thing to remember. If you get, that's the other thing which makes it almost impossible without the British government and the EU government, and that involves the EU government shifting and accepting that it does require maximum flexibility. The process can then be collapsed from the other end, as it has been in the past, by Sinn Féin. So if you give too much to the DUP and redesign the protocol to such an extent that that Sinn Féin say the protocol is protocol in name only, then Sinn Féin won't, you know, will have a veto until there's another election. The process, you know, there can then be a subsequent election, but you probably end up with roughly the same result, and the problem goes round and round in circles. Which brings me back to, I've acknowledged several times their Brexiteer blame for this, for being too casual or Panglossian, over optimistic about how easy it would be to fix. But I accept all of that. But it's now the European Union that is getting a lesson in how intractable this stuff is, and you have to be as creative as possible, as you know people were in the Anglo-Irish agreement, which was incredibly difficult and huge unionist backlash from the DUP and from others, or during the Good Friday agreement. And you need something of a similar order. Sorry to sound so gloomy about it, but without a European Union realization on this, an attempt to go further and get proper talks going with London and try and broker something, I can't see a way through this.
Is there not a way, for example, if the Irish and the British government kind of get together and decide, let's just make the EU annoyed repeatedly? Because one of the central obstacles to sorting this out is that, you know, when people talk to their domestic audiences, whether it's the unionist or the sort of nationalist side, they're also, in a sense, talking to an international audience and appealing for support. And the international audience is not always necessarily receptive, and it can also make it harder to talk between communities. And that's what the EU is now, I think, waking up to, is when you're dealing with this issue over the border and goods, you're not just talking to the British government, you're talking to the unionists in Northern Ireland and Dublin and all the rest. So surely the two parties who have the most interest actually in there being a good relationship over this are Dublin and London. And they need to come together and sort it out with whatever trust there is left and fudge it and do it the way, as you say, the Anglo-Irish agreement. There are plenty of noble examples in Anglo-Irish relations where we fudged a very difficult issue with a lot of historical blame attached and a lot of anger built up over time, but managed to find a diplomatic solution. So it sort of involves...
Right. Sorry.
Boris and Micheál Martin having a cup of coffee and doing it and actually putting in some 24 hours of work into it or something.
Right. Okay. So I'm presenting problems, but this is, we're talking about Northern Ireland politics. So it's appropriate. You run up against a problem with every optimistic suggestion. And there you've got to go back to 2016 to 2019, where it was made very clear, and the basis on which the last set of negotiations happened, the Brexit negotiations happened, was that Ireland could not be divided from the European Union. Right? So it is protected by the European Union, and the negotiations are through Brussels. So the Brussels was very clear that the British attempts to deal with separately with Dublin. Of course, there were certain talks, critical talks, weren't there, in 2019, but that was brokered with the European Union's help. When you remember when the Taoiseach and Boris Johnson met and agreed some advances, you know, met in the garden. But ultimately, the whole thing is defined by denying Ireland or denying the British any opportunity to try and deal direct on a bilateral term. So I don't see how that works either, I don't know enough about where opinion sits on this in Ireland itself. I don't think the Dublin government would have that much leeway for doing a direct deal to get Boris Johnson off the hook. So I don't see the motivation for it. So I've been incredibly negative about this, but I'm just I can't I can't see how you get some sort of deal unless the EU shifts and you get some sort of process, a bit like what you described, Alistair, with the with between the Irish government and the UK government. But I'm not holding my breath. Maggie, do you have I answered anything? Have I introduced any clarity at all, or just relentless negativity?
Clarity and sadly, negativity. But we have to be optimistic and hope that the back channels are open and that what we're hearing is all the belligerents on top.
I hope I'm wrong. You know, it's like how sometimes how I said there are unfixable historical problems, but just sometimes you're surprised. Yeah. And, you know, behind the scenes, there's a breakthrough and people decide to see things differently. And that's how sometimes history shifts. But we'll see. Shall we move on to another aspect of European history being back, which is, of course, is the war in Ukraine? Shall we mention first, Maggie, our Defence of Europe conference, which is at King's College? Yeah, it was King's College on London on Monday. And was put together with Reaction and the Reaction team in about 6 weeks. And it was quite a gathering, wasn't it?
I think it's fair to say it was a resounding success, actually. And the feedback we've had from people both speaking and our guests was that it was well put together. You could tell that, actually. It was very smoothly done. But some really great speakers, some really provocative thinking. And, yeah, everyone loved it. So it was great. We didn't solve another unfixable problem,
no.
But we had some very, very interesting ideas, particularly from Neil Ferguson, actually. I thought some of his comments asking why this war was lasting so long were particularly provocative. And I'm sure and we'll get into that later on.
And this was the idea that of just floating the thought that if America really wanted to finish this
endless
war.
Or bring it to some conclusion, it could
either through a combination of action and sort of stepping up aid even further and peace talks of some sort. So we also heard from the Defence Secretary being interviewed by Professor John Gearson from King's, and we had three panels, and it's all recorded, so the recording is available to watch for those of you who couldn't make it, and it had a good audience online as well. And we had, I think, more than 300 people there on the day. And I think we're going to do more of those sort of events, because it was inspired by conversations we had with Kings, really, just immediately after the war. It just becomes apparent that, and as you said, Maggie, we don't claim to have all the answers or to have settled it, but that there need to be pan-European conversations about the security situation and questions which arise from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You know, Sweden and Finland are not in NATO, though they're about to be. We'll come on to that in a second. Britain is not in the EU, but we all share the same neighbourhood and have a common interest in thinking about the defence of Europe. So that's what prompted it. And thank you very much to King's College London for hosting it at Bush House. It was a fascinating event. Just on the Sweden and Finland question, Alistair, how significant do you think that is? Can you see this? And it was mentioned at the conference, really, this the shift with Northern Europe and Britain. So Sweden, Finland, the Baltic countries, Poland, and Britain cooperating ever more closely. That's one feature of, which just demonstrates how much is shifting, changing since the invasion.
Absolutely. And you're kind of, it's actually been a long debate within the kind of European security architecture that is in effect being settled by Russia's actions in Ukraine. If you remember, over the last 10 years, there has been a tension within the European sort of Union and in the kind of broader security world between the Baltic states and Poland, for example, and somewhere like France and Germany, which have taken a rather different line on Russia and links to it, to the Russian economy and diplomacy and approaches to the Ukraine crisis, which let's remember began in 2014 as a kind of major international development. So that view, which is much more hawkish on Russian aggression, has sort of triumphed. And now Sweden, Finland, who, the reason why Finland is not part of NATO in the same case of Sweden is not because there are good reasons why those countries have not been part of NATO. I think it's important to say, i.e., there was a genuine perception in Finland for a long time that a kind of neutrality or a buffer status suited the Finns throughout the Cold War, was almost an honourable stance, given that they said that they relied more on their kind of capacity for self-defence, which was shown during the Winter War with the Soviet Union, very famously. And there's a genuine debate within Finland and Sweden that has been ongoing for many decades about NATO membership. And there hasn't been a majority for NATO membership in either country till relatively recently, and ever more so since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I think that there are lots of things we need to just sort of unscramble. One, there's a debate in America, I think, about NATO that is sort of more nuanced than maybe here, in that a lot of maybe DC sort of foreign policy types are now saying, well, just because Sweden and Finland apply to join NATO, we should still have a debate about what giving the US's security guarantee to two more countries means. It's important to have that debate. What does Finland, for example, gets that it doesn't get at the moment through NATO membership? And the answer is some sort of nuclear guarantee or guarantee against nuclear aggression. And that, I think that's a fair reason to seek NATO membership and to be accepted on, because of the way Putin has and people around him have implicitly threatened the use of nuclear weapons. So, but then Finland shares a long border with Russia. We're going to have to think about how we're going to manage that border, and that will involve talking to the Russians and saying, we don't want any kind of tripwire events where things scramble out of control. This is, we have to be careful about troop movements and exercises and all the rest. These were things that almost provoked nuclear Armageddon in the Cold War around the Able Archer tests in 83, for example. So in short, long answer and the short answer is, I think that there are obviously very good reasons for Finland and Sweden seeking NATO membership, but there are also equally good reasons to have a very vibrant and robust debate about what that implies for our security architecture and what's actually best for those countries. And anyway.
Did you see Maggie, the Boris Johnson, of course, visited and signed various documents and gave various undertakings. I mean, it does show, doesn't it? It just shows that if Putin, in that sense, wanted to divide the West with his invasion, I mean, he has to an extent, because Germany's struggling to work out precisely what its response should be. But it does seem as though Northern Europeans, as I said, are getting on with trying to settle some of this and forging closer links.
Absolutely. And I think it's fundamentally changed, if you like, the shape and brought together countries that are logically very close, genetically very close. So you have Norway already a member of NATO, but bringing in Sweden, Finland, the Baltic states, if you just look at, Tim Marshall would tell us the geography, Norway has a border with Russia, Finland's got, 1,000 kilometers. These countries live and breathe Russia in a way that perhaps we just don't understand over here. And those fears, latent fears, have been there for years. But they never wanted to be provocative. And the Swedes, as we know, for hundreds of years, have tried to be neutral, although that wasn't so easy in the Second World War. So it is a very, very big step forward, which will have all sorts of repercussions. And you can see countries like, well, we've seen already, countries like Poland really emerging in the Visegrad sort of group. But that's changed too, because Hungary is now, if you like, slipping away closer to Russia. So yeah, a big move. And we are now committed to backing those countries should there be any military invasion, which is a pretty big thing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. Should we just talk just quickly about the war itself? What do we think is happening, Alistair? I'm fascinated by what's going on in the Donbass. It's difficult to track in terms of, you know, there's all sorts of footage going on of explosions and attacks by Ukrainians or Ukrainians running a kind of guerrilla war in the Donbass. But is he actually losing or starting to come under attack in somewhere which, you know, Putin thought he was secure? The whole point of the invasion was to build on his existing hold in the east and build out from there. How much trouble is he in, if any?
I think, of course, it's risky. That's the gamble he took. Launching a war of that kind is always incredibly risky, because wars have a funny habit of getting out of control and developing in ways that he definitely didn't foresee at the beginning. I mean, the West had that problem in Iraq. You know, there were lots of things that happened which very few people envisaged.
True.
Once you press the button, you unleash a whole world of possibilities and realities which you just couldn't have envisaged. So I think short answer is there are sort of two interpretations still, broadly. One is more optimistic for Russia in the short term, which is they are making advances slowly but methodically, I would say, in the east, and there are signs that they are sort of doing a tactic which has been a feature of the kind of Donbass war, whatever you call it, from 2014, where, you know, they would create these mini encirclements or cauldrons where the Ukrainians would go into and make advances, and then they would sort of encircle and close round. And that's what the sort of rebel militia people were doing after 2014 with Russian help. And I wonder whether there's an element of that going on. They're sort of doing these pincer movements around villages and then coming round. And I also wonder whether the kind of Donbass offensive actually hasn't quite got going yet. I think there's an element where we interpret incremental gains as kind of failure, because it's not rapid advances, but this is war. It's harder than that. War is really difficult, especially when you're taking territory, which is very, very hard to do. And I wonder whether actually we're going to see another phase unfold where there are further advances. But then that's one view. But yeah, Again, it's so hard to tell. The other view is that the Russians have really stalled, and they're running out of munitions, or like the critical infrastructure to produce the kinds of amounts of munitions they need to then make more advances. And I think that's probably true as well. So there's that side to it. I just don't see how Russia takes somewhere. I mean, once they go through that bit of the Donbass, which is the stated aim of what they want to do, I just don't see how they do anything beyond that. Even if they do achieve that, and the kind of first scenario is the one that's true on the ground, beyond that, I mean, you know, the stated aim is let's make Ukraine landlocked, sort of, I think, or the kind of implicit aim. So that would involve taking Odessa and then linking up with Transnistria in the west and Bessarabia. And taking Odessa is going to be really difficult. And very, very, it's very well defended. There have been huge signals for like 2 months that they're going to try and take it. And you look at the kind of images from Odessa and the, you know, serious arm to the teeth kind of situation, huge defences out at sea, loads of preparations have been ongoing. So, I mean, beyond taking the next few towns and villages and potentially Kharkiv, I mean, what else are they going to be able to do? I don't know.
I referred to it earlier, Alistair, but the other thing that's going on is that it seems that the Ukrainians can, however they're doing it, can hit far behind the Russian lines, far behind the front line, and very close to the Russian border. The clip circulating this week, which seems to be verified, showing a Russian tank only 13 kilometers from the Russian border being blown sky high by the Ukrainians. Somehow, some debate about precisely how it was done. Which, a phrase I've heard several times in the last few days, is catastrophic victory. By which I mean, what are the risks that flow, Alistair, from Putin doing, say it turns out he does much worse in the Donbass than he'd imagined, and he is pushed back and can't control territory that he thought was his. So that's a real humiliation for Russia. What then happens in the aftermath of that? Because you're not then talking about a frozen conflict, you're talking about a situation that's then virtually impossible for the Ukrainians or the Russians to manage because of the demographics on the ground and public opinion. And we were talking before we started this about large parts of that part of eastern Ukraine really not wanting any connection with Ukraine itself at all. But if Ukraine wins, how on earth does the international community, but how on earth can the aftermath be managed?
Well, it's something to think about. Yeah, so on the kind of eastern Ukraine, I would say that until the war, the public opinion was roughly as follows. It was, we want to be part of Ukraine, but we want to be part of a Ukraine that is highly federalized and respects some sort of regional autonomy, some sort of language guarantees that the Russian language would be something used in official circumstances, that language of the state would be a bilingual state, you know, all that stuff, which has now gone by the wayside, really. So there's that. But we've got to also remember the Donbass has been ruined over the last 8 years. It is a total ruin of an area. This is a place which was the industrial powerhouse of Ukraine. Something like 8% of the population of Ukraine live there, but something like 17% of its GDP was in the Donbass until the conflict broke out. But even then, a lot of it was like ailing industry, like big steel industry that was actually subsidized by Kyiv. And this was a kind of point of political strife within Ukraine, within Western Ukraine, is what, you know, who are to a much different shape of the economy. It's more networked and more kind of westernized. And they say, you know, why are we subsidizing these old mining towns and all these old steel works and all the rest? But the Donbass now is it's just a ruin of a place. It's total, the population has been massively displaced. You know, this is a monumental mess. A lot of the people who live there, I think, will be pretty jaded by the war and just want to probably to go back to their lives and just want to be left alone, I imagine. I mean, the Donbass is a very strong regional identity within Ukraine, and that's always been true. We talked about that in the last podcast. It's actually even different to the Dnieper River, which is a kind of another industrial part of Ukraine, but again has a different kind of identity. So there is a strong local identity there. The Donetsk People's Republic, I mean, absolutely fascinated to find this out. There had a precedent 100 years ago where there was a Donetsk People's Republic declared in the kind of mayhem of the around the 20s. So the idea of Donetsk having its sort of own kind of kind of specific identity that is definitely Ukrainian, but not West Ukrainian, is a very long and venerable idea. But yeah, what transpires afterwards if Ukraine was to push Russia all the way out to what's known as 2014 borders? I mean, it would just, you know, there would have to be a coming together, and there would, and I think there would have to be encouragement from the West at that point for Ukraine to think about some sort of regional autonomy and all the rest, all the shebang that we've been talking about, that people have been talking about for years with regards to Ukraine. But do you think that, is there going to be much domestic support for that from the rest of Ukraine? Probably not, because they see these people as people who fomented civil conflicts and made things a hell of a lot worse and appealed to Putin for years. I mean, this is another thing that people should remember. The DPR heads and the LPR heads repeatedly after 2014 asked Putin
for Russian help.
Yes. And Putin kept on not really helping them out and kept on saying, have a ceasefire, don't hold elections, please try and become part of, you know, part of Ukraine, because it's a problem for the Russians that they don't, I don't think, you know, whereas Crimea, there's an obvious strategic depth to having Crimea, i.e. Sevastopol, warm water ports, all the rest. The strategic depth you get from the Donbass, I mean, is not the same, apart from getting a land bridge to Crimea, which to an extent they'd circumvented anyway by building that massive bridge between Crimea and Russia. So, you know, for years he was saying, I'm not bothered. And then he's gone in to try and settle the issue and these demented plans to denazify the Ukrainian state and all the rest. And I think he's compounded the problem, but it's a problem of his own making, because the nationalist forces that he had used in Russia for a long time to cement his support were always going to fixate on Ukraine as a kind of ultimate battleground, you know.
But this is the madness. Yeah,
different part of Russian nationalists thinking that Ukraine is a kind of, you know, is the kind of little brother that gives the big brother his identity. Yeah. I mean, it's
And this is the madness of the situation created by his invasion, because it potentially makes it post, Ukrainians are doing a phenomenal job and defying expectations, but if they do get that victory, what's created is then an ungovernable space, isn't it, with various insurgencies and counterinsurgencies running, and probably needs to be some sort of international protectorate, but that's then very difficult to negotiate. Maybe that does then point to some sort of, that becomes a key part of peace talks at some point, but those are talks that are very difficult to have with Putin. I think we'll move on from the war, and we'll talk more about that next week. Maggie, you wanted to raise the question of working from home, which is a very live issue, because the government and Jacob Rees-Mogg are criticising civil servants for apparently too many of them refusing to come back to the office, and there is concern in business about what's happening. What's your take?
Yeah, no, it's you know, I think people have been quite staggered actually in what a shift lockdown has had on how people see their work. And we saw this week somebody saying, you know, work is no longer, is not a place, but a sort of state of mind. And that's sort of true for many of us who are lucky enough, we can work from anywhere really. But for millions of people who, you know, driving the buses and all the rest of it, they've got to be in their place. But what I think, and we're hearing lots of situations where recruiters and companies are finding it really difficult to employ people, because they're basically bargaining, blackmailing the employees, saying, well, I'll only come on board if I can work 2 days in the office. And so it's a very real, as you say, live problem. What I do think, I mean, companies will sort themselves out, and I'm sure this will sort of calm down a bit, but there will be a consequence. And the train companies, transport companies, are going to have to refigure their timetables. Pricing is going to have to change, because I live at a big commuting station, Audley End, on the Cambridge line, you know, which used to have about 1600 cars per morning from 7 o'clock in the morning. And because of the defence conference, I took the 703 this week, which is the first time in many years. And the car park was, you know, half empty. It's staggering. Mm. You know, 2 years ago, that would have been absolutely packed out. or rather 3 years ago. So I think it's going to have lots of repercussions that people haven't thought through.
Where do you stand on this, Alistair? I mean, I have mixed views. I don't have a hard and set view. I hear some friends or employers say it's outrageous, people need to get back and you're not really working unless you're in the office, and then others saying that the whole nature of work has changed and people have to adapt. I suppose I pathetically sit somewhere in the middle, but then we have all three of us have experience going back pre-COVID, because you know, Reaction is a small media company, and well, we had an office in central London just before in Westminster just before the pandemic happened. But we're now doing what lots of small companies are doing. We're mixing and matching, aren't we? We're recording this podcast from home. I find working from home, I find I get a lot done without the commute, but then really need also the energy. It's the energy that comes from central London and from talking to the team, meeting the team. We had a meeting, didn't we, a few weeks ago, Alistair, where we got so much done that would have taken weeks or months to transact on Zoom and probably wouldn't have quite happened. But with an hour-long meeting over a coffee in the office that we're using a couple of days a week, we sailed through it, and it was very creative. So I'm afraid I haven't answered the question, but how are you finding it?
I think there's a kind of nuance, which is that I think the flexibility is good. But then I think in terms of offices, we should criticise, for example, the open plan office as a disaster and a terrible turning point in Western affairs. That is probably one of the soft reasons why our productivity is not great, because open plan offices are just the worst for productivity. And that's what I don't actually like about being in the office sometimes. If you want to actually get stuff done, you can't have people just coming over and wanting a quick chat, which is normally about nothing. You know, you just need to be in, you need to be in.
You can't talk about your colleagues like that.
Yeah, but it's chit chat. You know, it's on the surface, it's interesting and helpful, but it's just not, is it? It's just fluff.
Meant to be the water moment,
Alistair's going to be so popular with his colleagues after that. But I take the point exactly what you mean. But we're older than you are, Alistair. So most of our working lives have been in large offices, in large newsrooms, which have, I suppose, a fantastic energy when a story is breaking and all the rest of it. But most of it, the mundane thing, the day-to-day stuff, you're absolutely right. By the time people get in, make themselves a coffee, sort of see what's happening, catch up with a few colleagues, someone else comes over, it's just time passes very quickly and it feels like busyness. But maybe you're right. Maybe that explains some of Britain's poor productivity.
Somebody said to me,
"Let's have a meeting disease."
You know, we don't go to the office to work anymore. Work has become the sort of social chit chat place. So you have to go back home to do the serious work.
Britain. We have too many meetings, and you know, it's always the "let's have a meeting." And I just think, actually, nothing ever gets side in a meeting. You just get on with it, and that's how things get done, you know. And the only thing you do need to be in for is massively intense projects where you're constantly communicating about small things. So when you're bringing together a print thing, of course you need to be in the same space, because it depends on you physically interacting all the time. And it's a night, you know, I've seen people do complex things over Zoom, like actually very, very difficult things over Zoom in design terms, but it's sort of nightmarish, because you're all sitting on the same sort of Teams page for hours on end, effectively just going between different bits of your screen. And I've seen people do that as well, and it can be done, but it's very unpleasant. So, and that was really a kind of pandemic thing, I think. But I guess it comes back to the civil service debates, obviously. You know, the kind of Rees-Mogg tactics of putting a note on people's desks, being like, where are you? where you at? But I don't know. I don't have a view really on. I think it's probably two separate things. I mean, people talking about how bad delivery is in the civil service and working from home. And when people talk about working from home, we tend to be actually talking about how poor civil service delivery is. But I don't imagine working from home actually makes a huge amount of difference.
Yeah, it's a class component as well, isn't there, in that a lot of the people who are most in favour of working from home have gardens, plenty of space, can finish doing things like recording podcasts and go and sit in the garden and potter about. And actually, the office, when it really works, I suppose, in large organisations, is an engine of social mobility and spurs ambition and all the rest of it. I mean, learning
yeah. Younger. I think certainly all the youngsters I know in their 20s, young lawyers, accountants, bank, you know, that sort of middle workers, they really missed it because they do, or used to, you know, learn from their elders, get help and so forth. And
yeah, which I suppose in newspaper terms, Maggie, a lot of that used to happen in the pub, didn't it?
It was the pub.
And it was also learning, observing people get things wrong as much as right, seeing mistakes made by oldies. I'm sure that still happens virtually as well. But just that dynamic, that excitement of just picking up at speed, seeing what people are doing. But maybe it's me just being sentimental and romantic for old newspaper offices. But I have to say, I've done it for quite a long time, even pre-pandemic, the mix of different styles of working. And I don't think we're going to go back to everyone being back in the office manager. I know there'll be some people listening to this who disagree and think I've gone soft, but I just think people will be, particularly if they're starting companies or doing something creative, I think people will more likely to mix and match. But we'll see.
It'll be a pick and mix.
Yeah, let's see. Actually, we haven't. Because we've talked about so much, we haven't talked, Maggie, about the economy, and but we're not going to depress people further with it.
No, let's save that for next week.
Recession and all that sort of stuff.
It's not as bad as people want you to think it is. All about confidence. So go out and spend a bit this weekend.
Hooray! What a good optimistic way to end this podcast for listeners who are thinking it was all getting a bit downbeat. But you've been listening to the Reaction Podcast with me, editor of Reaction, Ian Martin, and my colleagues, Maggie Pagano and Alistair Benn. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction and you want my weekly newsletter on politics and Maggie's column and Tim Marshall and all the other great things produced by our team of writers and editors on Reaction, the details are below. Become an annual subscriber to Reaction. And until next time, thank you very much for listening to the Reaction Podcast.